morning and welcome to the conference call. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Hartwig to begin.
Thank you, Rachel, and good morning, everyone, and thanks for jumping on the call. I just have a couple of quick process things before we turn it over to Jeff to walk through the PowerPoint you see on your screen. There will be an opportunity at the end for some Q&A. The operator will prompt you, so if you have any questions, you know, please hold on to them to the end, and we'll get through everybody that we can. The only other thing that I would like to add before Jeff starts is that we have spent a lot of time and effort analyzing this issue, both from a corn supply side, from an RFS and how it functions side. And so if you use this material, we would just ask that you do so with proper attribution, either to the RFA where it makes sense, or to the sources that we have cited, because they have done some good work in this area. So with that, again, welcome, and Jeff, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Well, thanks, Matt, and thanks to everyone for spending a few minutes with us this morning. You know, obviously there's a lot going on in the ethanol world today. The agriculture industry is facing the worst drought in over 50 years, and certainly by now all of you have probably had a chance to digest last Friday's reports from USDA, you know, taking a look at just how the extent of some of the damage to U.S. crops. You know, we've also seen in recent weeks calls for a waiver to the RFS as a result of the drought conditions. So we just thought this would be a good opportunity now that Friday's WASDE report is out and people have had a chance to look at it. We thought this would be a good chance to spend some time discussing with you our you know, the ethanol industry perspective on the current dynamics, and take a little deeper dive into what is actually happening in the marketplace in response to these record high corn prices, and also to take a look at some of the flexibilities inherent within the renewable fuel standard that will allow compliance even in the event of a short crop this fall. So again, by now, you know, you've all seen the numbers from USDA last Friday. The WASDE report estimated the 2012 crop at 10.8 billion bushels. That is obviously down from about 13 billion bushels with their July estimate, and down from June's estimate of 14.8 billion bushels. So in the course of a couple months, we went from potentially a record crop to the smallest crop we've seen in 6 years. Excuse me. We're looking at a crop that would be down about 13% from last year's harvest of 12.4 billion bushels, and again the smallest since 2006 when we harvested 10.5 billion bushels of corn. So as a result of the drought and the hot, dry conditions this summer, we've seen some opponents of the RFS use the situation as additional leverage to press for repeal or reform of the RFS. These are the same groups that have been gunning for the RFS for a number of years. And they've really, attempted to strike while the iron is hot, and seize upon the emotion around this summer's drought. And really, these are some of the arguments that they're using. You know, 2 weeks ago, we saw a coalition of meat groups send a letter to EPA Administrator Jackson asking her to use her own authority to initiate a waiver of the RFS requirements for the remainder of 2012 and for 2013. And again, these are the types of arguments that we're seeing in the letters that are being submitted to Administrator Jackson, and just the PR effort and campaign that's being waged by the meat groups and other opponents of the RFS. You know, and really the key argument that the meat groups are waging is that, well, gosh, you know, the ethanol industry just isn't going to share in demand rationing because they have this RFS. And, you know, the renewable fuel standard creates this immovable, inelastic source of demand that is like a vacuum that is going to suck up 5 billion bushels of corn no matter what happens. and the rest of us are going to be left fighting for the scraps. You know, they've argued that waiving the RFS would free up a bunch of corn and would have meaningful impacts on reducing feed prices. You know, there's others that are suggesting the RFS is actually driving up consumer food prices. And most recently, we've heard arguments from some that the RFS is causing higher gas prices. So we're going to kind of methodically look at each one of these arguments and explain why, you know, these arguments really ignore what is really happening on the ground today, and ignore some of the flexibilities built into the RFS. And you know, these are obviously geared toward what these groups ultimately want, which is a waiver of the RFS. And here's just kind of a high level are the facts and a reflection of what's really happening on the ground today. The ethanol industry is responding very rapidly and very substantively to record high corn prices. We've seen corn consumption by the ethanol industry drop significantly in recent months, and I'll walk through some of that in a minute. We've also seen ethanol exports decreasing. They kind of started declining in May, held somewhat steady in June, and then anecdotally we're hearing that ethanol exports, you know, generally dried up in July, and at the same time we've begun to significantly increase imports of ethanol from Brazil. The other thing that's happening is, you know, we had record ethanol stocks, record amounts of ethanol in storage earlier this year in March and April. And so what you've seen as a result of the current situation is those stocks are beginning to draw down and get closer to kind of normal carry levels. So that's kind of what's happening on the market side. And then when you look at the RFS itself, there is a lot of flexibility that's built into the program that was put there by Congress when they passed the Energy Independence and Security Act in 2007 and was, you know, further, I guess, put a finer point on it when EPA actually wrote the rules to implement the RFS in 2009 and 10. And so this flexibility that's built into the program really allows the corn market and end users of corn to adjust in a natural way to price signals and what is happening in the market. And you're not seeing this hard, inelastic, you know, mandate having these drastic types of effects that some would have us believe. So really our point has been that the flexibilities in the RFS and the responsiveness of the market itself make a waiver completely unnecessary, and really a waiver would be completely ineffective in reducing corn prices, as I'll show in a moment. So here's what the ethanol industry has done really over the last 2 months. When you began to see corn prices start running up in early June, the industry was very quick to respond by reducing its consumption of corn, and you know, in recent weeks we've been running at a rate that's about 12% below the industry's run rate in early June, and about 15% below where we were running at the beginning of this year. Today, as we speak, there's about 1.5 billion gallons of capacity that is idled. Some of that is very recently idled, and some has been idled for quite some time, multiple years. But all told, we're looking at about 26 ethanol plants that are completely idle right now. But the other thing that's happening that is somewhat different than the last time we went through a rough patch in 2008, is you've seen a lot of plants, operating below their capacity. You know, in the past, it's kind of been a situation of, you know, an ethanol plant is on or it's off. But today what we're seeing is the industry has gotten much smarter about running at maybe 75% or 80% capacity, and that's obviously having some impact on the amount of corn that the industry is grinding. So here just graphically is a look at the industry's response to the run-up in corn prices. The red line that you're looking at there against the left axis is corn prices, and I just use the Iowa corn price as a benchmark. And it shows, you know, corn prices rising rapidly from about $5.80 a bushel in early June to current levels of about $8 a bushel. And what you've seen concurrently is the ethanol industry's response, and that's the blue line. You've seen the ethanol industry go from consuming about 96 million bushels of corn a week down to current levels of 84, 85 million bushels. So when you annualize that corn consumption, you know, back in early June, on an annualized basis, we were running at about 5 billion bushels of corn grind. The most recent four-week average would suggest we're closer to about 4.4 billion bushels on an annualized basis. So in the course of 2 months, the industry has reduced its corn grind by about 600 million bushels. And this chart just takes a longer view of weekly ethanol production to really just highlight just how dramatic the drop in production has been in recent weeks. Again, if you look back to 2010, 2011, the industry was producing well in excess of the implied requirements of the RFS, and that's what the red dotted line is. And so, you know, when we were producing in excess of RFS levels and obligated parties were consuming those levels in excess of their obligations, they were generating excess credits for complying with the RFS. In other words, if a refiner's obligation in 2011 was to blend 100 gallons of ethanol and he blended 120, well, he can bank those 20 extra credits and use those for compliance this year. And so, you know, what you see in 2012 toward the, you know, the far right side of the graph there is that in recent months we've been operating below the level that would be necessary to meet the RFS with wet gallons. But again, we've accumulated this huge amount of surplus credits in the last several years that will allow the industry to continue operating below that red dotted line and will still meet the RFS in both 2012 and 2013 because of these surplus RFS credits that are available in the marketplace. Most estimates suggest there's somewhere around 2.5 to 2.6 billion of those credits that might be available to refiners for compliance. You know, I mentioned ethanol stocks. We hit record levels earlier this spring in the March-April timeframe, and as you would expect, we've seen stocks tighten up a little bit in recent months as ethanol production has seen a slight downturn. But, you know, what the blue line shows is that we're still slightly heavy in terms of the stocks that we're carrying. The red dotted line is a 20-day supply of ethanol based on what current gasoline demand is. And that 20-day supply is kind of a benchmark that's used by industry to indicate a kind of healthy supply-demand balance. And as you can see, we're still above that 20-day supply line here in recent weeks, even while we've drawn down stocks by a pretty good amount in the last several months. So, you know, the point of this is there is still a fair amount of ethanol in storage that can be pulled out of storage by blenders and refiners in the event that we are short on production. I mentioned ethanol exports. We're certainly seeing some adjustment in exports and imports. Last year, we had record exports of 1.2 billion gallons. This year, you know, in January or February, we were thinking we might export somewhere around 800 or 900 million gallons for calendar year 2012. Today, I think we're figuring that number has probably dropped to 500 to 600 million gallons. And as I said, you know, anecdotally, we're hearing that in July and the early part of August, exports have really slowed to a crawl. And in the meantime, we are substantially ramping up imports of Brazilian sugarcane ethanol to assist blenders and refiners with complying with the advanced biofuel carve out of the renewable renewable fuel standard, but also to offset any shortfall that might be occurring in domestic ethanol production. So again, if you look at Friday's WASDE report from USDA, and again, if you're using kind of the meat groups mantra that, well, you know, the ethanol guys aren't going to have to share in rationing, Friday's report from USDA really showed that that isn't true, and it isn't a reflection of what's happening, and certainly not a reflection of USDA's thinking. What this chart shows is corn use by the four major end users, comparing the July estimates from USDA to the August estimates. And what you see, first let me back up. The first thing I want to note here is that, there's been all this rhetoric about, the ethanol industry is going to be the largest user of corn in 2012-13. They're using more corn than the livestock industry. And that just isn't true when you take the time to understand that a third of the corn we are grinding goes right back to the livestock industry in the form of distillers' grains. And so what you see with those first four columns there is I have taken the third of the amount of corn that the ethanol industry will use that ends up as distillers' grains and essentially moved it over into feed and residual use where it belongs because that's where it's being consumed. And what that shows you, obviously, is that feed use will continue to be the leading use of corn in 2012-2013 marketing year by a sizable amount. Beyond that, what this shows is that all users of corn are going to share in the rationing, according to USDA. Just between July and August, USDA reduced gross corn consumption by the ethanol industry by 400 million bushels. That ends up being an 8% reduction. They trimmed livestock feed use by 13%. But again, that's just feed use of corn and distillers' grains. They increased the feed use for wheat. They increased feed use for barley and oats. And so, as you would expect, you're going to see some substitution from other coarse grains and some feed wheat that will help close that gap and help the livestock industry continue to meet its needs. We're also seeing, fairly significant rationing in the export market. And as you might expect, smaller rationing with other food, seed, and industrial uses. But the bottom line here, obviously, again, is that, look, we're all going to share in the pain here. The ethanol industry is not insulated from this situation. So I want to turn quickly to what this all means for compliance with the renewable fuel standard. Again, you've heard many of the livestock groups say, well, look, if you keep the RFS in place, the ethanol industry is going to get its corn and the rest of us are going to have to fight over the scraps. But if you waive the RFS, we're going to have all this corn freed up, and that'll help us out. Well, I mean, when you look at the requirements for 2012 for the RFS, the requirement is for 13.2 billion gallons of renewable fuel, and again, that would be ethanol from corn and sorghum primarily. But it's really a requirement again for 13.2 billion RINs. So we could produce far short of 13.2 billion gallons and still comply with the program because of those excess RIN credits, the RFS credits that are out there. And I'll walk through that in a little more detail as we go here. And here's a few other things that need to be kept in mind when we talk about meeting the 2012 RFS. The statutory volume, the requirement established by Congress is 13.2 billion gallons, yes. But when EPA sets these renewable volume obligations on an annual basis, they use that 13.2 as a divisor against projected gasoline and diesel fuel demand, and they come up with the percentage. And so this year's percentage, for instance, was 9.23%, meaning 9.23% of every obligated party's fuel needs to be comprised by renewable fuel. So if actual gasoline and diesel demand turns out to be lower than what EPA had initially projected, then the actual obligation for RINs is also lower. And that's exactly what happens, has happened so far this year. 9.23% of gasoline and diesel demand today is lower than it was last November when EPA set the standard. It's about 13 billion gallons versus the statutory level of 13.2 billion. So right there, just through that little mechanism, you've already reduced the requirement by about 200 million gallons. You know, we talked about stocks and the fact that refiners and blenders will pull from stocks in the event that the physical market gets tight. You know, we talked about RINs and the fact that obligated parties can meet 20% of their current year obligation with RINs from the previous year that they have, you know, put away in their bank and saved up for a rainy day. Again, there's about $2.5 billion of those RINs sitting out there. And then finally, and this is a point that you don't hear people talk about much, if all of these other mechanisms fail, or if there aren't the RINs out there that are needed, and production really falls off a cliff, a refiner can carry a deficit forward for 1 year. And there's really no limitation on how large that deficit is. So here's just a high-level outlook for 2013. The RFS statutory requirement increases to 13.8 billion gallons for renewable fuel. And for the first time, it looks like we're going to have the RFS requirement be above what we refer to as the E10 blend wall. If you look at EIA projections for gasoline demand next year, they're looking at about 133 billion gallons. So that means, you know, a maximum of 13.3 billion gallons of ethanol could be used as E10, which would be, you know, 500 million gallons short of next year's requirement. So the way we meet that requirement is, you know, through increased E15 use, and we're already seeing some E15, being sold commercially today. It's a slow rollout, but it is continuing, and we kind of expect things to pick up this fall and into next spring with E15. But the other thing that is going to help refiners meet their obligations in 2013, again, is the abundance of surplus RFS credits that are out there and ethanol stocks. This chart just shows really how low corn use for ethanol could drop for the 2012-2013 marketing year, and still have us produce enough ethanol to meet the 2012 and 2013 RFS requirements. What you see on the left side of the screen there is the amount of corn that would be needed to produce 13.6 billion gallons of ethanol, which is, you know, kind of the crop year, the marketing year equivalent RFS requirement. So you need about 4.9 billion bushels of corn to produce that amount of ethanol in the form of wet gallons. But when you take into account that 2012 RVO adjustment that I explained that knocks, you know, the 2012 requirement down to 13 billion gallons, when you take into account the amount of ethanol in storage, which is the second green bar there, and then finally when you take into account these surplus RINs, which represent about a billion bushels of corn, those three factors could actually reduce the industry's corn consumption by about 1.3 billion bushels without any need for any kind of waiver. We could conceivably grind about 3.6 billion bushels of corn in 2012-2013 and still meet the RFS targets in both years. So again, this is just to illustrate the significant amount of flexibility that exists within the RFS and some of the flexibility that exists just within the marketplace as well. So, you know, again, when we start talking about, well, what would an RFS waiver really accomplish? We hear the meat groups say, well, it would substantially lower feed prices. It would free up a bunch of corn for us and make our lives a lot easier. Well, that's not what the experts are saying, and when you look at what you know, some economic analysis is showing, it's demonstrating that a waiver would have little or no impact on corn prices, and really no discernible impact on retail food prices, and you just wouldn't see things change much in the event of an RFS waiver. You know, and if you look at some analysis from Iowa State University that Professor Bruce Babcock conducted, he showed that, you know, because of these surplus RFS credits and because of stocks and because of some of these other things, a waiver would really have little impact on corn price above and beyond, you know, the impacts that already come from these flexibilities. And I'll highlight his results in a second. You know, you might see a minor decrease in ethanol output in the short term as a result of an RFS waiver, but you probably wouldn't see much of a reduction because there is strong demand for ethanol irrespective of the RFS. Refiners, you know, are producing 84-octane gasoline today, and they can't sell that to you and I at the retail station. They have to upgrade it to about 87-octane in most states. And the way they do that is by blending in 10% ethanol. And we've been told anecdotally that kind of undoing the refinery configurations to get back to, you know, refineries producing 87-octane blend stock would take 3 to 6 months. And so you're just not going to see a quick response by refineries to an RFS waiver. And there's just, you know, as I said, strong demand for ethanol independent of the RFS in the short term. Now, the longer term effect of a waiver may be that, you know, the refineries move back to higher octane blend stocks and some of these other things. And so in the longer term, you may see some ethanol demand erosion. But by that time, you know, the 1 year waiver would probably be over and would be getting back to the RFS as scheduled. But the other thing that an RFS waiver would do is it would send a chilling signal to investors in the advanced biofuel space. You know, there are a lot of investors on the sidelines today who are kind of waiting and watching, and they want to see what EPA is going to do with the RFS and want to see if EPA is going to cave to pressure from the livestock groups and you know, what is Congress going to do, if anything. And a waiver would obviously, you know, tell the story to this group of potential investors that the administration, you know, isn't as committed to this program as one, you know, as an investor would need them to be in order to plop down a sizable investment in next generation biofuels. You know, a couple other things that would happen is you'd obviously slow the commercial rollout of E15. Again, I highlighted that 2013 is kind of the first time that the RFS really kicks the market in the pants to get some E15 into the marketplace. If there's a waiver of the program, that isn't going to happen. And then finally, I think, you know, waiving the RFS for 2012-2013 would send a strong signal to farmers to plant less corn next year. And so again, you know, if the intent or the desire of the livestock groups is to get more, you know, access to more corn, an RFS waiver sends a signal to farmers to do just the opposite. Here's just a real quick summary of the results from Professor Babcock that I alluded to a moment ago. He modeled several cases, but I just show kind of the key results from the case where he said there's no RFS waiver versus the case where there would be a full RFS waiver in the 2012-2013 corn marketing year. And he shows under the case where you waive the entire program, you only see about a 4.5% reduction in corn prices, you know, a 28 cent per bushel reduction. And certainly that's not the type of relief that the livestock folks are seeking or certainly not the type of impact that they are claiming would happen. He also shows about a 300 million gallon reduction in ethanol production, which also works out to about 5%. And I just pulled out some of the key quotations from the study there, and Professor Babcock says that, you know, because of these excess RIN credits and because of these other flexibilities, you know, waiving the ethanol requirement may not result in as large a drop in feed costs as the livestock groups hope. So, you know, as I mentioned at the front end of the call, one of the latest avenues of attack from some of our opponents is on gas prices now. Obviously, if you've bought gas in the last couple weeks, you've noticed that retail gasoline prices are up again. They've increased about 40 to 50 cents a gallon since the beginning of July. And last week's average was actually the highest since the middle of May. And so what you've seen is some opponents of the RFS attempting to shift the blame for these higher gas prices onto the drought. And they're saying, you know, we have higher corn prices because of the drought. And because we have higher corn prices, ethanol prices have been bid higher. And so those higher ethanol prices are transferring through to the retail level. And, you know, it's true that ethanol prices have risen about 50 cents a gallon since the end of June, but we're still about 40 to 50 cents a gallon cheaper than gasoline. And that's not something that you hear from the opponents very often, if ever. You know, EIA put out a nice short analysis last Wednesday that looked at, you know, the factors kind of leading to higher gas prices. And they specifically looked at the impact of ethanol and said, you know, there's really no evidence that the ethanol price increase has been passed on to consumers at this point, and that really what's driving higher gas prices, as you would expect, is higher crude oil prices that we've seen over the last 6 weeks or so, and some of the problems in the refining sector. I mean, if you've been watching the news, you obviously have seen coverage of the big refinery fire in California and resulting, outage of that refinery that is really having some impact on West Coast gasoline prices. You know, beyond all that, there have been several folks look at, you know, what is the impact of ethanol blending on gas prices kind of beyond the straight blend economics. In other words, what's the impact of extending our gasoline supply by nearly 14 billion gallons last year? And depending on whose study you look at, you know, that impact is anywhere from 84 cents to $1.07 a gallon in reduced gasoline prices. So this argument that ethanol is the cause of higher gas prices in recent weeks is just ridiculous. So then the other one we hear all the time is on food prices, and again, this is an issue that that reporters love to seize on, and you see higher food prices in the headlines all the time. But really nobody ever takes the time to look at what is really happening with food inflation in historical context. And when you do that, you see that USDA is projecting 3% food inflation for 2012, which would be right in line with the average from the 1990s and 2000s. And actually quite a bit below annual food inflation rates in the 70s and 80s. And then for next year, 2013, you know, when you would expect these, you know, the impact of the drought to kind of work through to the retail level, they're calling for about a 3.5% food inflation, or 3 to 4%, which again would be not all that much above historical norms. You know, it's interesting that nobody was writing or talking about ethanol's impact on food inflation in 2010, when it was less than 1% and the lowest in 50 years. So this is just one of those kind of hot button emotional issues that we've been dealing with as an industry for really since the beginning and will continue to. But when you step back and look at the facts, you see that there just isn't much impact on food prices from the drought overall, and then more specifically, really no impact from the ethanol industry. And this graphic just kind of further underscores that. This graphic comes from USDA. They put this out very recently, and I think it's a nice visual to kind of explain when you go into a grocery store and spend a dollar on food, what that dollar is paying for. And 86 cents of that dollar obviously goes to, food processing and packaging and energy and all the kind of supply chain expenses that you see there. And 14 cents goes to the value of the agricultural commodities that are in your groceries. And that's all agricultural commodities, and corn is just one of those. And ethanol is just one piece of the corn market. So again, if you look at Professor Babcock's numbers, and you know, we're having a 28 cent per bushel impact on corn prices, when you work that all the way through the retail level, it just isn't credible to suggest that the RFS is having these major impacts on food prices. So then, you know, when you get people to understand that, they say, well, what about the rest of the world? Because our food is so processed here in the U.S. and because we spend so little of our income on food, yeah, it doesn't affect Americans that much, but what about the rest of the world? Well, you know, again, when you explain to people that U.S. corn and distillers grains exports have always gone to feed meat-producing animals in the developed world and not to humans in developing countries and third world nations, it kind of sheds new light on kind of the global equation. So then, if you look at the impact of the RFS and other ethanol policies, you know, historically on food crops like wheat and rice, you see very little kind of crossover impacts there. Again, Professor Babcock did a study for a multinational NGO last year looking at the impact of the RFS and the tax credit, which is now gone, on world crop prices. And what he found in the last year that he looked at, which was 2009 and 10, he said about a 3 cent per bushel impact on wheat and 4 cents per hundredweight on rice. So, far less than 1% impact on both of those food crops. And then finally, the reason these impacts are so small is that the U.S. industry uses a very small portion of the global grain supply. Last year, we used about 3.1% on a net basis. This year, according to USDA's latest numbers, would be using about 2.9% of the global grain supply to produce ethanol here in the U.S., and that would be the lowest rate in 5 years. And this is, I think, the last slide I have that I just wanted to close with and just remind folks that, the corn market is global in nature. And, everybody's looking at the top line of the table that I've got on this chart here and the 13% reduction in U.S. corn output this year. But when you balance that against what's happening, all over the rest of the world, we're seeing fairly substantial production increases expected in places like China and Argentina, Mexico, Canada. When you balance the reduction in U.S. output against what's happening in the rest of the world, the global corn crop is going to be down less than 3% this year, according to USDA, and it would still be the second largest corn crop on record, falling behind only last year's record crop. So again, because this is a global market, users are going to adjust. You saw USDA actually projecting 75 million bushels of corn imports into the U.S. In the coming marketing year. Those are the kind of adjustments that are going to happen to get us through this short crop here in the U.S. And certainly the world will adjust. Farmers in the southern hemisphere are seeing this $8 corn price. And you can bet that they're going to respond by planting substantial corn acres here in the next, coming weeks and months. So I think that's what I've got in terms of material. Here's just a quick summary, kind of take-home messages again. I just want to underscore that our industry is, in fact, responding to higher corn prices. We're reducing production. We've seen exports drop dramatically. Ethanol producers are and will continue to share in rationing corn demand. There's no question about that. Obligated parties under the RFS have lots of flexibility in meeting the requirements in both 2012 and 2013, and that wealth of banked credits will enable compliance in both years. Waiving the RFS would not meaningfully reduce corn prices or overall feed costs, you know, one thing that we didn't talk about is if you're producing less ethanol, you're also producing less distiller's grains, and you're going to have higher distiller's grains prices, and that's going to have some offsetting impact on feed costs. If you waive the RFS, you're going to see far less soybean meal production because the soybean is crushed for the oil. And so there are offsetting effects that nobody, everybody's talking about impacts on corn price when what they should be thinking about is kind of net impacts on overall feed cost. In the off chance that a waiver did result in significantly reduced production, you would see gasoline prices increase. I think there's little debate about that. As you would be removing ethanol from the gasoline supply, the response would be to see higher gasoline prices. You'd also see, as I alluded to, less distillers grains and far less soybean meal produced. And that would have some impact on feed prices. And then finally, I think there's all the evidence shows pretty compellingly that the RFS really has no discernible impact on retail food prices. So again, I'm sorry this has been a little bit long-winded, but we did want to take this opportunity to kind of share our perspective on some of the debates that are happening today and kind of shed our light on the dynamics that we're seeing in the marketplace today. And I think at this point, we'll open it up for questions.
At this time, if you have a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, press *1 to ask your question. Your first question is from the line of Patrick Rucker.
Hello.
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm sort of new to this issue, but this has been really good for me, Jeff, to that was Jeff, right?
That's
okay,
right.
Thanks. Yeah, to a good primer for me. One thing, if we can, for the sake of this argument, let's say that there was a waiver. What's your expectation of what would happen for demand in sort of an unregulated or not, without the mandate, the day after that? What would sort of happen to that demand from refiners? In terms of oxygenation or octane question, like,
right? I think you would see very little immediate impact because. Refiners over the course of the last several years have retooled their refineries to produce these lower octane gasoline blend stocks, and so they're set up. They're kind of locked into using 10% ethanol in most instances, and you can't just the refining industry can't just undo that. Because there's talk of a waiver or if a waiver was granted that it they're not just going to stop using ethanol tomorrow. It would be again anecdotally we've been told kind of a 3 to 6 month process to kind of go back to higher octane blend stocks. But who's to say they would do that? If blending ethanol continues to be economically attractive,
right.
Again, we're still 40 cents or so under gasoline,
mm-hmm.
And far below other octane sources.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the event that there was a waiver, it doesn't mean refiners are immediately going to go to work retooling to work ethanol out of their mix. Mm-hmm. Economics will certainly have something to do with that.
I mean, can you sort of even put a finer point on it? Imagine, this is kind of highly speculative, but I mean, what would that point maybe be? In 6 months from now or something like? How do economics work?
It is hard to speculate on that. And I think if you look at Professor Babcock's work, he shows about a 300 million gallon. Slippage in ethanol production
resulting from a waiver, you know, about a 5% reduction, you know, through next August. And I, you know, I think we think, something in that magnitude, would be reasonable, over that time frame. Now, in the longer term, you know, it may be different. But again, you know, a waiver, according to the statute, is only good for 1 year.
Yeah.
So by the time a refiner would have retooled to work ethanol out of his mix, you know, then the RFS is coming back, and they'd have to go right back the other direction. Mm-hmm. So we just wouldn't envision much slippage in ethanol demand in the near term.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's something. Yeah, there's been an interesting show that parts of the story that maybe aren't reported as widely. Is that sort of demand is already built into the system anyway?
Right. Yeah. Right. And you know, there's a similar circumstance for distillers grains. You know, the animal feed co-product. Yeah. A lot of beef and dairy rations are, you know, kind of locked into using distillers grains and to make substantial changes to those rations, you know, it's going to take some time, and they're going to have to figure out, you know, if they're taking those products out, what are they going to put in?
Yeah.
And so, it, you know, it isn't just on the fuel side; it's on the feed side as well.
Just so I understand this, you said it would take 3 to 6 months. Again, just for the sake of argument, for the refiners to adjust to what to do what they wanted to get the octane blend that they want to use that doesn't rely on ethanol.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we've been told.
Yeah. Is that in that research that you were quoting before, the Bob Babcock?
I'm sorry?
Is that the same research you were quoting?
No, it's not, but it's, I mean, that information is in the public domain, though.
Oh, okay.
And there are some other analyses that cite that 3 to 6 month time frame.
Okay, maybe when the call's done, if you or Matt could maybe, yeah. Oh. And then this might be a question for Matt. I think we're going to meet in person and talk about this kind of stuff. But I mean, being in Washington, you can't help but look at the same hypothetical. And I wonder if you're right about the flexibility. That's not talked about as much by the people who want to get this waiver. Maybe I don't know if Matt can talk about the politics of wanting to get the waiver, because, you know, if you get the waiver once, then you can, it'd be easier to sort of make an argument the next time. They don't, it seems that the opponents just don't want to talk about the flexibility. They want to just get the waiver.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Matt's line is live still at this point.
Okay.
But obviously that is a huge concern for us is, you know, a decision to waive the RFS in 2013, I you know, would put us on a slippery slope, and, you know, would make, future waiver decisions, more likely, you know, in our mind. And so, you know, we think, the EPA's decision to reject the 2008 waiver request set a very high standard for establishing the conditions that must be met to effectuate a waiver.
Mm.
And we think that standard needs to be, you know, that is the standard, and that's needs to be upheld not only this year but in the future.
And the folks who won the waiver, not only did they, and this, maybe one could argue that they failed to get the waiver, but they sort of got something they did win, which was the EPA thought through the process and created the standards, you know, the explicit standards for. Is that public? I'd love to look at, like, their thinking in 08 and what they said public.
It is absolutely public. It's available on EPA's RFS website.
Okay. And I don't know if maybe Matt can help guide me to that as well, because I think maybe that's maybe underreported or under not properly understood.
Right.
That they have thought this through, and they've talked about a standard, and they've talked about the tests.
Right.
Hey, Ezra, this is Matt. You and I can follow up. I want to let a couple of the others who have some questions.
Okay, sorry. Sorry,
your next question is from the line of Brenda Wright.
I did a great job with the presentation today. I just wanted to ask quickly if there's any talk in D.C. about changing the gasoline standards, I guess more specifically the required octane levels within the gasoline pool.
Well, you know, octane is not currently regulated by EPA. There is, I guess, some discussion about how, you know, how octane and other gasoline properties will be treated under Tier 3 regulations that are, you know, kind of beginning to take shape at EPA, but we won't likely see any proposal on Tier 3 until after the election. But yeah, I mean, there is some discussion about, you know, what role EPA has in you know, requiring minimum octane levels or you know, regulating octane.
Okay, so it doesn't seem like it's being talked about right now.
Well, it's being talked about, but again, I think you know, that discussion is really going to gear up when discussions get serious about the Tier 3 rulemaking process, and that's, you know, that's several months down the road yet.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question is from the line of Mark McNamee.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks very much for that presentation. Very well done. Very helpful. Question about, we've had a couple of, you know, as you mentioned, there have been several requests of EPA to initiate a waiver review, and I think most recently from a couple of mid-Atlantic governors, Maryland and Delaware. You know, theoretically, if EPA were to go ahead with a waiver review, we know what they did with the Texas request in 2008. You know, based on that, what do you think is the key question boils down to for them? You know, in reviewing the current situation, does it come down to whether the mandate is likely to be binding or not, or how do you see
it? Really, the lens that EPA has to look at this through is whether implementation of the RFS requirement would severely harm the economy or the environment. And so again, if you go back to the 2008 decision from EPA. They you know, pretty clearly establish what is meant by severe harm, and they also underscore that you know, it's their interpretation that implementation of the RFS itself must severely harm the economy, not the drought. I mean, one could certainly argue that the drought is severely harming the economy, but you know, that's independent of the RFS, and it's not enough that the RFS would contribute to any economic harm. It has to be the root cause of that severe harm. So, I mean, that's really the standard that EPA would have to look at, and certainly as part of that, Mark, they would look at, you know, what are the expected production levels, you know, given corn prices and given everything else happening in the marketplace, how much ethanol is physically going to be produced versus what is the availability of surplus credits that are out there in the marketplace. And they know better than anyone how many, you know, surplus RINs are out there.
Mm-hmm. I would also, you know, it's also from my reading of it anyway, one of the things they mentioned back in 2008 was, in terms of severe harm, it's not enough to just show that it's injured or is harming one industry.
Yeah.
It's severe harm is as they saw it, much has to be much more broadly defined than that. So
economy wide, that's right.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And I guess I should point out as we're waiting on the next question, the other thing EPA did in 2008 and would do again in response to a waiver request is you know, actual economic modeling that looks at not only the impact of a potential RFS waiver on agricultural commodity prices, but it would also look at the impact on fuel prices. And what they found in 2008 is, you know, there was virtually no impact on retail food prices, very little impact on corn prices, but those impacts would you know, be offset at the consumer level by increased fuel prices.
And your next question is from the line of Marie Brill.
Oh, thank you very much. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about sort of looking forward. I think you make a good case about how the RFS is not binding this year, largely in part to excess production of ethanol and the banked RINs. But if we run through that this year and we deplete that stock of excess, and next year we have another drought or flood or tornado, even if it's not as bad as the one now, wouldn't the RFS start binding again? And I'm wondering that especially because you also make a case for how difficult it is for a single year waiver through the EPA to actually be put in place in time to make a difference in the right. midst of a crisis. So kind of looking forward, wouldn't it be giving greater security both to the ethanol industry, but also sort of to the market in general, if there was built into the RFS a stronger waiver mechanism that would enable the mandate to reduce even partially when there's time of low corn stocks and low ethanol stocks?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, in response to that, I would say, you know, we've looked at a number of different scenarios for 2012 and 2013. And really, under any case, you know, we can get through 2013 and meet the RFS without much of a problem. I mean, ethanol production can fall pretty low in calendar year 2013, and we can still comply with the RFS of 13.8 billion gallons because of these surplus RIN credits that are out there. I mean, we might potentially use, you know, 300 to 500 million of those excess credits for 2012, and that still leaves over $2 billion for next year. And so, you know, theoretically, we could produce as little as 11.8 billion gallons of ethanol in 2013 and still meet the requirements of the RFS. Now, if we do encounter, you know, another year like this next year or you know, some other situation that would put some strain or some stress on the ethanol and corn markets again, you know, when we start talking about next year's new crop, then yeah, I think we'd need to sit down with EPA, we'd need to sit down with other stakeholders and figure out the best course forward at that point. But assuming this is a one-year deal, we have the flexibility necessary to get through it.
And then just a quick follow-up. When you were looking forward towards 2013 and beyond and potential of another, you know, stress on the market, how does that change then if we're blending more gas, if E15 really does start to pick up over the next couple of years? Like, does that change your calculus at all or make it, you know, sort of more important for us to figure out a more lasting solution?
Sure. Well, you know, I think the move to E15 is going to be, you know, very measured. As I indicated earlier, you know, we would need about 500 million gallons of ethanol consumed as E15 next year to meet that target with wet gallons, if we didn't have all these surplus RINs sitting out there. And I think, you know, 500 million gallons of E15 next year is pretty optimistic. So I don't see E15 rollout putting a whole lot of additional pressure on the ethanol market in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months. And in the event that it would, you know, ethanol prices would respond accordingly. And, you know, supply, demand, and price would kind of work to sort these things out.
The next question is from the line of Silly Sangi.
I just wanted to ask, in terms of flexibility and looking forward, do you think it would be reasonable maybe for EPA to sort of keep in its back pocket the ability to maybe extend the rollover of RINs for more than just 1 year?
Well, I mean, you know, RINs, the RIN market is essentially refiners are able to do that already. And really the reason is, you know, RINs are kind of a first in, first out system. So, you know, refiners started building this bank of RINs, you know, several years ago, and they always surrender their oldest RINs first for compliance and save their newest RINs to roll forward as far as possible. So, I mean, that's kind of how this mass of RINs has accumulated. You know, in other words, they used excess, you know, 2009 RINs. They used up those first to meet their 2010 obligation and then used, you know, and then filled the remainder of that obligation with 2010 RINs and, you know, kept on rolling everything forward. So it's kind of this rolling bank that does kind of allow that flexibility that you're talking about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but no, it does. And I mean, but I guess in the case where you may need to, where maybe allowing them to use a 2008 RIN, let's say for the 2010, well, to do it for more than to lengthen the period in which they can sort of redeem them.
Well, I guess I would say, you know, in the event that you know, that things start to get tight and compliance looks to be in jeopardy or, you know, if things get, you know, worse, then yeah, we're going to want to sit down with EPA and talk about a whole host of options, but we're certainly not there yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Again, to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. Your next question is from the line of Brian Sim.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you for the presentation this morning. I just have a question on, with regard to, given the circumstances that everything's been with the drought and the political theater going on, you guys as RFA be a dark horse in this, and when it goes back to cellulosic ethanol and advanced biofuels. You mentioned Brazilian sugarcane ethanol being anticipated to be imported into the U.S. to fulfill the advanced biofuels requirements under the RFS, but has this encouraged other build-out of isobutanol or cellulosic in the future?
Well, good question. I think we're certainly seeing you know, continued progress with cellulosic ethanol. There are a handful of plants that are well under construction and should be producing gallons. You know, if not in late 2013, certainly in 2014. But all of this uncertainty around the RFS program, you know, makes those guys anxious, because if it's easy to just take a hacksaw, to, you know, kind of the conventional renewable fuel portion of the RFS, what does that mean for those guys, if things get somewhat uncertain for them moving forward? So I think, you know, they're watching this as closely as we are, and advocating that EPA, you know, stick to its guns and implement the program as it was designed. I mean, that's going to be the best thing for that industry in terms of, you know, keeping the progress moving forward toward commercialization.
Thank you.
Your next question is from the line of Chris Stanley.
Hi, Jeff. Great presentation. A quick question. EPA, kind of similar to the last one, EPA, should they choose to deny the waiver request or I'm not even sure it's a valid request, but should they choose not to grant a waiver of the RFS, which it seems correct, that should be the correct action, they still have an obligation to review the overall RFS standards due to the multiple year waivers of cellulosic ethanol that have already happened. Do you have any feel for how that might play out? I mean, that could be really a separate question from the waiver issue and certainly a separate set of legal requirements. Obviously, our preference would simply be for EPA to say that, again, EPA has the ability to set the cellulose requirements on an annual basis, and they should simply do that, but I don't know if you've heard anything different.
Right. Well, I mean, we have had a few discussions with EPA on that issue, and
just to, I guess, make sure everybody on the call understands, there is a provision that requires EPA to revisit the overall RFS schedule in the event that they have had to waive some or all of the cellulosic biofuel standard in consecutive years, and they obviously have done that. But that requirement to kind of relook at the schedule doesn't really kick in until 2015. And, you know, the discussion that we've heard from EPA is that they're, you know, giving it a couple more years before they really sit down and think about what adjustments may be necessary beyond 2015. And really, to your point, Chris, I think, you know, again, when we talk about flexibilities built into the program, EPA could continue to implement the RFS through 2022 exactly the way it's done the last several years. They have the authority via their annual rulemaking process to adjust the cellulosic biofuel standard based on what they think will be available. They have the authority to adjust the overall advanced biofuel standard based on what they do with cellulosic biofuel and other factors. So again, there's a lot of flexibility already in the program. EPA has the authority to make adjustments, and there's safety valves and off ramps already there. And so, you know, that's one reason that we have always said we don't think any congressional action is needed to revisit the RFS, and we think EPA can continue to implement it as it was originally designed.
Hey, Jeff, I'm going to take the opportunity. I don't believe there are any more questions, but we've also been going for quite some time. So I think we're going to take an opportunity here to end the call. As always, if you have additional questions for Jeff or for the RFA, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. You can reach Jeff. What's the best way, Jeff?
I'll just give out my email address, and if people have follow-up questions, probably the best way to get me the next few days is via email, and that email address is gcooper@ethanolrfa.org.
Great. Well, thanks, Jeff, and thanks, everybody, for sticking with us.
Thank you.
This concludes today's call. You may now disconnect.